Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to The Hour of the Time with your host here, Doyle Shamley, in Eager, Arizona. Now, this evening here, we're going into part 10 of the Minuteman series with more need-to-know information. But first, I have some very special announcements to make besides the mundane ones. So, let's start with that. If you'd like to contact The Hour of the Time, you may do so by writing Hour of the Time, or HOT, H-O-T-T, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona 85925. Again, that's Hour of the Time, P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona 85925. The website, hourofthetime.com, that's hourofthetime.com. Studio number, 928-333-2942, that's 928-333-2942. And my personal email address, hourofthetime@hotmail.com. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we've been talking about the new release. It's a wonderful 4-DVD set of one of Bill's all-time classic speeches. It's never been released before, though. So unless you had the fortune of attending that large seminar in Sedona, Arizona, you've never seen it. Many people who were able to attend or were able to read transcripts afterwards have hassled us to do it. So that's what we started off with on our big project of converting tons of the old video seminars onto digital and releasing them. So this first one, the Sedona set, it's 4 DVDs. 4 DVDs. Professionally edited, multiple camera angles, excellent audio. It's a really nice package. And what we're going to do is offer this at an introductory special for all 4 DVDs in one package, $25 postage paid. That's cheap, ladies and gentlemen. A 4-DVD set for only a $25 donation. Now, it's on the shopping cart, so simply go there, and you can place your order. You can, of course, mail it in if you'd like. To the P.O. Box, 940, Eager, Arizona, 85925. 4 DVDs for only $25, never before seen. It's the Sedona set. For Hot Club members, because Hot Club members always, besides getting a free MP3 of the month of every broadcast for their donation, for $40 membership in the Hot Club, you get every broadcast of the month on an MP3 disc, separate files, so they're convenient to manage for your MP3 listening devices on your computer, what have you. But you also always get breaks, and so $10 off for Hot Club members, only $15 for the 4-DVD set. And like any of our products, Hot Club always saves. So on this introductory special, Sedona is $25 for the 4-DVD set. If you're a Hot Club member and you have your Hot code, and if you've lost it or forgotten it, just email me or call me and I'll give it to you. And Hot Club members have a special code to get their discount. So, also, CMRI.TV. CMRI.TV. I've been talking about it all week. Monday and Fridays. It's a new venture of ours with James Lloyd. It's actually pretty neat. This week is the herbal walks and training from Dr. David Christopher of the School of Natural Healing. that he did with the attendees of last year's conference. So you can get an idea of just some of the things you get to learn when you come to conferences. Now, of course, we're not going to redo the same thing as last year at this year's. He's covering whole different topics. But the DVDs are available for the whole conference of last year. But this week on CMRI.TV is the Herb Walk with David Christopher. Now, I made a mistake the last couple of days about the latter time. Initially, we had agreed at 2 and 5 p.m. Pacific time. 2 and 5 p.m. That's in the afternoon. Pacific time. It's 2 and 6. We're going to be doing it at 2 and 6 o'clock, and we're going to stay there for the time being. 2 o'clock and 6 o'clock, Mondays and Fridays. So be sure to catch it this Friday if you miss Mondays. That's CharlieMikeRomeoIndia.tv. Now, for next week, we have something very special to show you as well that the participants in last year's conference got to take place in. And it's something many of you have queried about seeing, asking the location because you're going to be driving through various questions, etc. We had done a campaign in the old studio after Bill's murder where we asked people from all 50 states to send rocks in. I know it sounds bizarre, but rocks indigenous to their region or rocks that had a little story behind them. And we got all sorts. We had rocks donated that couples who had been with us for years had found on their honeymoon on the beach 20-something years ago. We had beautiful crystals and volcanic formations and geodes and oddball rocks that look like caterpillars almost, like multiple round shapes joined together, or some kind of bug that only form in one particular area of the country, things like that. Other ones that change colors when they're wet and they have fossils in them. And at the conference last year, the participants got to help build the final grave site markers and memorial for Bill out of all this. And the idea was to have all 50 states represented. So that was a nice time for a lot of people. It was a hard time for a lot of people as far as emotionally. Because ironically, two people, and this is totally random, taking them out of their packages and padding the rocks, two people actually grabbed rocks that they had sent in. And this is just me randomly grabbing them out of these massive boxes. So that was pretty neat. And other people that couldn't make it to the funeral brought tears to their eyes, whatnot. That is what we're showing next week. So this will be the first time, except for an occasional snapshot. At like Memorial Day, I always go put flowers, because he's a veteran, on his grave. I get red, white, and blue bouquets. And a flag. I always make sure to put an American flag up. And birthdays, etc. But except for the occasional snapshot we've shown, no one's ever seen this unless you were there at the conference. So that's what we're showing next week. So this is an opportunity for you to see what went into the memorial and the gravesite markers and to see pictures and panoramas and some of them. And again, this is one of the special activities. Every conference we have special activities like that. That wasn't scheduled in the itinerary. And we have stuff lined up for this year, ladies and gentlemen. It'll be just the same. I can't list every single thing on there because it'd get completely bizarre. You'd see like a 2.5 hour class and a 15-minute break and then maybe a 30-minute activity and then a giving away of free books from Hour of the Time. I'm not going to list all that. So the itinerary is all the main topics and points of the conference, but we do a whole lot more. And that doesn't even count all the fellowship in the evenings and the friends you make and the friendships you forge with people and you stay in touch with them inherently. I still stay in touch regularly with people from the very first conference years ago. So keep that in mind when you're on our website, hourofthetime.com. Be sure to go to the conference page, Conference 2007. Look at the details, and like I say, I highly suggest you make it, because it won't be long before we won't be able to have conferences in this country, ladies and gentlemen. And that's why each year the skills are purposely planned, so you build a repertoire, and in case something happens right after this conference, you have a good base to work with, and if we're let loose, by God's grace to do it again the following year and the following year. We just keep building with new and additional skills. So, ladies and gentlemen, those are the main announcements. And again, as always, remember, the hour of the time is listener supported. And I want to thank James and Rob and Terry and a bunch of them for all their hard work on this video project and the upcoming videos that are coming out too. We're hoping to do one a month now that we've got our systems in place and equipment. One new release a month out of the archives that no one's ever seen. But we want to tackle this big one first because of all the demand and request over the years for it. So don't forget the new release of Sedona. Package 4 DVDs in a box set for only $25 postage paid. Hot Club members, of course, save even more. So go to the shopping cart, find that. It's on the front page. It's on the DVD and video page. Or you can write in as well. And you can use money order, gold, silver. We don't care. We'll barter with you. Now, we're going to take a musical break before we entertain. Well, I have a special announcement after, an update on some politics after the musical break. And then we're going to go into part 10 today, a recapping of some of the sections on guerrilla warfare. And continue on with our Minuteman series. So we've done guerrilla warfare and leadership. I'll recap and get into planning. Planning, oh so critical. So make sure to have your notebooks and stuff ready, something to drink, some water or something. I'll try to actually remember to do the same thing. Last night I forgot to and had to take a musical break to go get something to drink. So be ready to take notes and right after this musical break. Ladies and gentlemen, again, your host here, Doyle Shamley in Eager, Arizona, with the Hour of the Time. Episode 10 in our Minuteman series, a training program to teach you Americans who are actually concerned about their country, their freedoms, you Canadians, whoever, about how to make an effective force, an underground force, if you will, a Minuteman force. to defend your country and freedoms against enemies, foreign and domestic. Now, to recap some of the previous broadcast, number 9, we covered much of the history, but just in passing, because the research is up to you. The gist was, remember, to get the principles of why these guerrilla actions helped to save their country and our country, especially in World War II, all around the world. And then we got into leadership, some of the basic principles of what a good leader needs to be able to do. And don't be led to believe, ladies and gentlemen, if you have never led troops or people in trying times, don't be led to believe the BS from academia that you can simply do it by inspiring and pointing fingers and getting people to just do a bunch of extra work. You must lead by example, the credo of the non-commissioned officer corps of the United States military. Lead by example. And their oath, the very long creed that you swear to uphold, starts out with, I am a professional, I am the most professional there is. Ladies and gentlemen, you need to remember that. You can't expect people to do dirty, crappy work that you're not willing to also do. But you also need to be a leader in the sense of organizing things, an overview of multiple tasks at hand. So to continue on with leadership and principles therein, we finished up with that if a job or task had not been done properly, then the leader lost a lot of time and efficiency and didn't really do a good job of leading, did he? Now he must either do it himself or start the whole process over again, the basic 3-step process we gave you. That's not efficient. And you're not going to have endless supply chains and endless amounts of time to do things. And if a task is sufficiently urgent and important, a good leader won't hesitate to do it himself rather than call someone else to do it. And in any case, a good and competent leader will always use the possible smallest increment of people necessary to get a certain task accomplished. Don't wear out your people. Oftentimes, anyway, assigning more people than is necessary ends up in loafing, BSing, idle chatter, than just getting the task done at hand and being completed. And a person can never be a good leader unless they have developed and have good working habits themselves. Any good leader knows that for certain academic studies, a clean, good work area, orderly surroundings greatly improve efficiency. If you have a task out in the field, you're building a field hospital, our infrastructure has collapsed, and you're building up for the local community, some military tentage and stuff, you don't go out to the safe site that's maybe 4 or 5 miles away and take the tents and not the poles. Or take the tents and poles and not generators for lighting at night. Or the generators, tents and poles and no fuel. Or all that and no water. Efficiency. And a good leader always recognizes the value of time. Time management is a crucial skill. I taught it in the military to my lower non-commissioned officers below me and from other units. I taught it to peers. And then when I left the military and went into the corporate world, briefly, thank God, before I left, I taught it in middle management level to the entire facilities. Time management, time. It's important. In times of need, ladies and gentlemen, some people will think a few minutes here, a few minutes there is no big deal. Oh, what's 5 minutes over here? Big deal. Or, oh, we got to drive back and get the fuel for the generators so we can set up this hospital to help our community. No big deal. It's only 5 miles each way. But to a natural leader, and I'm kind of leery of even that term, whether that even exists, a natural leader, every single minute is important. Because him hawing around is not real rest for the people doing work. If you've got to erect a field hospital and transport and put it all up, if it can be done effectively in an 8-hour day, it should be done. And then let the people off to have a break. Time with their families. Time to gather their thoughts. Wash up. Keep morale up. Shave. Do laundry. What have you. But if you stretch it out into a 14, 15-hour day through inefficiency and just him-hawing around here and there, then your time off in a 24-hour period is greatly reduced. It will hurt morale, physical, and mental health as well. Let's give you some examples, ladies and gentlemen, of good work ethics and habits and good leadership traits. Now, I've changed these from examples we would use in the military, so they're Mr. and Mrs. and things like that, and businessmen now. But suppose Mr. Jones and Mr. Smith or each returning to their respective offices after having been gone a few days. Suppose each is met on his return by their secretary and two assistants. Mr. Jones' secretary says, "Hi, boss. How was the trip?" "Well, not too good," says Jones, who then spends an hour or two giving his fellow workers an account of his trip. While talking, Jones looks around the office and gradually realizes that it is filled with work that is piled up in his absence. Some of this work his assistants could have done but haven't. And that's why they're followers rather than leaders. While the rest needed some decision from him before it could be completed. Jones, his secretary, and assistants spend the rest of the day deciding which of the back work is most important and who is to do what. And by quitting time, they're farther behind than ever. Now, Mr. Smith, he returns to his office, and his secretary says, "Hey, boss, how's the trip?" "Fine," says Smith. "I'll tell you about it as soon as we get caught up on some other things." Then he says to his assistants, "You fellows wait for me in your own offices. Clear your desks for action. I'll be there to see you in a few minutes." What does this do, ladies and gentlemen? It keeps his assistants from confusing the situation with unimportant conversation. So while waiting in their own areas, their offices, getting ready, and knowing the boss will be coming soon, they will probably do some needed straightening up. And perhaps even hurry through some job that should have already been finished. And then Smith turns to the secretary and says, "Is there any one thing that is most important to take care of?" Now, unless it's really urgent, he'll probably let it go. For now. Instead, he will find some job he can get his secretary started working on as quickly as possible. And this keeps her busy and productive while Smith finds jobs for the assistants. They don't need to be important jobs, necessarily. It's only necessary that his assistants keep busy at the job for a reasonable amount of time with a minimum amount of supervision. As long as it's necessary work, ladies and gentlemen. Then returning to his office, Mr. Smith takes the next most obvious job and starts doing it himself. And if it's a routine task, hopefully, requiring little concentration, so much the better. This leaves his mind free to survey the general situation and place other tasks in proper order and assign them to workers in an orderly manner. Now, from these examples, you can see that one might correctly decide that the first essential of leadership is the ability to see work that needs to be done when others are unable or unwilling to do so. In fact, a person can be a good person and a good worker without having any leadership potential. They're a good follower. They work steady, skillfully, and they do everything that's expected of them and even above and beyond when they see the opportunity to do so. And then that leader must have a strong, compelling desire to get the job done. Anything else that can be accomplished efficiently and as quickly as possible. These traits are absolutely necessary. And until a leader or a prospective leader has this drive within themselves, they sure can't ever impart it to anyone else. And without that drive and that mindset, a good leader won't be anything else other than another good follower. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I want you to think about something. I talked to you about how some people confuse charisma and the ability to point fingers with being a good leader. The charisma, the talking and speaking abilities, the flair for public relations, their appearance is all they get their support from. And I'll give you some examples of that. Hitler was able to do so, wasn't he? So was Napoleon, Franco, Roosevelt, all known socialists. They were admired and supported by millions of people that they never even met through those traits. But their real ability to get their jobs done was their working relationship with their close and comparatively few people around them that they did have personal contact with. Not agreeing with any of their tactics, policies, or acts. I'm just saying, of some of the most famous leaders, Roosevelt, Hitler, Napoleon, Franco, on and on and on. It wasn't just the charisma that got things done. They knew who they could rely on, how much they could rely on them for task at hand. Now, to go into something, another section that is a little more specialized leadership, and we'll be talking about the guerrilla leader now, ladies and gentlemen. You know, most humans are apt to get in a mode or be inclined to wishful thinking. But that doesn't always work, obviously. Let's take a few simple facts. Even though communist and socialist movements have already said throughout history they will not rest through all these slow creeping encroachments that they're doing, the building blocks of their final strike, until they've conquered the whole world. But most people won't even allow themselves to consider that possibility, so they just ignore it, thinking it's going to go away. And when the time comes for open resistance warfare, the hot war, if you will, and when it suddenly comes, there'll be hundreds of civilians and Americans all around, people wherever you live, wanting to fight and help for everyone that is trained or equipped to do so. And there lies one of the problems. So, under those conditions, when that occurs, each member of various patriotic groups and militiamen and minutemen around the countries that are ready for the emergency because of broadcasts like ours here on the Hour of the Time will end up acting as leaders of new guerrilla bands. So, as part of the testing and self-training that you must go through in your band, that you must consider is how quickly can each of you, when suddenly you're a new leader of hundreds of people who have the gusto, let's say, to do it, but just not the equipment or training, how quick can you get them up to speed It's something you need to consider. Can you maintain discipline and security? So really, you need to do some introspection, if you will, and take some very serious thought as to your own abilities and shortcomings as a leader. Past experience throughout history has brought up a few points that are even taught in the war colleges around the world. Point one, the leader must have a strong personal conviction as to the righteousness of the cause for which he is fighting. Two, he must have the ability to infuse other members of his band with the same conviction. Three, he must be able to exercise effective command over his band through personal loyalty and political enthusiasm when no other means of discipline are available. The leader must be able to keep secrets and organize even quite important actions so that as few people as possible know the plans. Remember? Information getting out is basically the square of the number of people that know it, as far as the chances of it getting out. Five, the leader must be capable of deceiving the enemy. Six, the leader must be able to act inventively and imaginatively so as to constantly seize the initiative away from the enemy. 7. The leader should have risen to his position of leadership through his own abilities and exertions. Not just be appointed because he's a buddy, like in the federal government. The leader should be physically vigorous and self-denying so he can accommodate himself to primitive surroundings. The leader should have no addictions or strong habits that might distract him at some crucial moment. The leader must have the bulldog tenacity to see that important tasks are completed no matter what difficulties or obstacles may be placed in their path. The leader must have the patience to remain inactive when it is the best course and wait for exactly the right time to strike. And the leader must have the moral courage to accept full responsibility for his actions and those of his band. Ladies and gentlemen, these are all important traits, and again, followed up with more testing, not only just based on the broadcast, but outside work that anybody would be expected to do. And as we get closer to the end of this series, we'll start telling you some special opportunities that you have to partake informing organized bands of Minutemen in your area. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I want to go to a musical break now, and I'm going to grab a couple things I wanted to read to you outside of the core programming this evening, just to let you know of a couple new bad things going on in our Capital Washington District of Criminals. So after this musical break, be prepared for some more up-to-date news information on legislation, and then back to the core content of the program. ladies and gentlemen. Again, you're listening to the Hour of the Time with your host here, Doyle Shamley, in Eager, Arizona. Tonight, episode 10 in our Minuteman series. But first, some old new news. And I say that because it actually took place initially, the notices all over, yesterday, and I forgot to mention it on the broadcast. Shame on me. Just so you know, the immigration amnesty bill has been renumbered. So if you haven't caught wind of that yet, via news alerts, etc., it has been renumbered. So you need to hassle them senators. The Capitol Switchboard 202-224-3121. Again, the D.C. Capitol Switchboard 202-224-3121. Now, S-1348, the amnesty bill, has been called now S-1639. It's political maneuvering, ladies and gentlemen. And remember, Lindsey Graham, who's offered this amendment to rescue the Bush-Kennedy-McCain amnesty bill, all known socialist, he's a Republican out of South Carolina, is simply a protege of CFR member and Republican presidential candidate and shameful, shameful senator from our state of Arizona, unfortunately, John McCain. So remember that, ladies and gentlemen. Now, I have news alerts, etc. I can send if you wanted more information in text. So just email me at hourofthetime@hotmail.com, and I'll email that to you. But it's essentially been renumbered from S-1348 to S-1639, and you can check the renumbered bill status and roll call votes at thomas.loc.gov. And also in my alerts, I have a whole list of 800 numbers, if that'll help you, for the Capitol switchboards. So you don't have to call the toll number if you don't want to. Now, ladies and gentlemen, with that said, I wanted to relay something to you that under leadership abilities that comes to mind because it was a very pleasing time to me for a medal I got. It's not nearly the highest as far as the ranking of medals is concerned that I earned. I earned 3 substantially higher medals than this one, but this one in particular meant the most to me. And after seeing my platoon, and I'm not doing it to brag, I'm just giving an example of kind of a self-test. You'll know when you're a good leader when something like this occurs, because those that you're leading recognize it and appreciate it. And after some particularly crappy times on some military operations we were involved in, unbeknownst to me, at a formation one evening, I was called up for a medal by my commanding officer. And it was from my own platoon. Put me in for it, wrote it, everything. All the stuff that's not really typical, per se, of privates and corporals and whatnot. And the gist of it was, this one wasn't for any acts of heroism and some of the other ones that I had received medals for that had much higher ranking on the military scale. But this one meant the most to me because the commander wrote, they went to the commander and another platoon sergeant to get help in writing it so it would get through, because of course, like anything else, there's a stack of paperwork to get anything done and it must be in the proper format, etc. But they essentially said that because their platoon sergeant had watched out for them, ensured that they were always safe and secure to the best of his ability, worked with them at all times, didn't point fingers, kept the morale up, always looked out for his troops. That one Sergeant Shamley was getting put in for this medal and received it. And that one meant the most to me. Because a lot of those higher medals, let's face it, you're young, you're stupid, you do ignorant things in the face of danger, and you happen to get medals. A lot of it comes down to that. And really, if people would just be honest, a lot of times they get those medals not looking out for the cause, not looking out for their division, not worried about the safety of the United States 15, 20,000 miles away. They were acting in a survival instinct. Really to bail them and their closest friends out. That's most often the case in some of those high up medals. And anyone that will be honest with themselves who's earned those will admit it. This one meant something though. It wasn't for doing something that I really didn't think about at the time, my own safety or whatnot. This one meant something. Because it was after a month-long operation. And quite honestly, I had no clue. It was a complete surprise, and I hadn't purposely done any of these things. It's just what I did, because those were my troops. No one was going to mess with them. They were going to work better than anybody else, perform better than anybody else, and get plenty of time off when they could to hang out and keep the morale up and keep maintain personal affairs. So it's just an example of a little litmus test you can give yourself. You'll know when you've done a good job. And you'll also know when you've done a crappy job. I've done both. Now I want to get into this next phase, which is planning. Planning is oh so important. And although the underground Minuteman movement, your bands of Minutemen defending our country, or whatever country you live in, from socialist and communist aggressors, both foreign and domestic, you must always avoid fighting when success is uncertain. Sometimes calculated risks must be taken to ensure the continued growth of the organization and bands. And because of that, the underground must rely on careful planning to maximize success and minimize risk. Let me give you an idea of this at work. Training manuals of resistance groups in Vietnam, for instance, summed it up in this paragraph, and this worked best for their people. One must study the situation in the opposing camp. That is to say, one must try to find out the dispositions of the enemy, the attitude of the cadres and the combatants towards one another, their morale and their fighting value. Follow closely the opponent's activities, the deployment of his intelligence service, transport, relief of pickets, all given evidence of his intentions, and so make it possible to plan operations with every chance of success. And the manual went on to say several other things, ladies and gentlemen, that we were taught. It pointed out the importance of determining the enemy's weak points, morale, provisioning, laxity, and stated that if the enemy protects himself carefully, without presenting any weak points, we must create them before attacking. So, contingency plans. Let's get into that. In planning any attack on aggressors and invaders, foreign and domestic, of our constitutional republic and our freedoms, the underground must develop contingency plans which can be implemented in the event the original plan proves impractical. Therefore, the failure of one action taken in the course of a mission will not necessarily jeopardize the security of individuals or compromise the mission itself or the entire organization. Let's look back, if you want an idea of that, in 1943. Otto Scorzini, attempt to kidnap Mussolini from an Italian mountain resort hotel. You can see a great illustration in that for contingency planning. This stronghold where Mussolini was at, this mountain resort hotel, was on a jagged plateau in the Gran Sasso mountain region, 6,000 feet above sea level, and considered invulnerable. There would be no chance for a second mission should the first one fail. Therefore, on Hitler's instructions based on limited intelligence, three plans were devised. Plan A called for a lightning air attack on the nearby Italian air base in the valley. Minutes after the attack, three German transport planes were to land there, one of which would pick up Mussolini while the other two diverted ground fire. If this plan failed, Plan B provided for a small plane to land in the meadow in the valley directly below the stronghold, pick up Mussolini, and transport him to Rome. And Plan C was the most dangerous of the three. A light plane would land directly on the whole hotel grounds and pick him up. In the actual operation, Scorzini could not make radio contact with his headquarters in Rome to give the go-ahead for Plan A. Plan B automatically went into effect but failed because the plane was damaged while landing. Plan C finally succeeded, though, and Mussolini was delivered to the German headquarters in Rome. Contingency planning, ladies and gentlemen. Rehearsal. Another important aspect. And it's a method of increasing the probability of success through engaging extensive rehearsal of the mission. Now, the success of this method, obviously, is largely dependent to the extent of adequate intelligence. And in preparing a raid, ladies and gentlemen, intelligence information enables the underground to make a mock-up of the military installation to be attacked. Moves are pre-planned. Terrain. Multiple entry or ingress and egress routes, entry and exit routes, and the members involved in the operation must know these things. In the Philippines, for instance, on several raids by pro-freedom forces, and on the basis of intelligence reports, a shopping list, if you will, of certain items to be collected from the installation during the attack was prepared and issued to the members of the raiding parties. And in this way, they could be assured that the required items would be taken in the shortest possible time. Enemy countermeasures and the actions they take and the actions needed to cope with them must also be considered, planned, and rehearsed. Small attacks could be launched, for instance, against a future target to determine where the reaction force will come from, or reactionary force, and how long it'll take to arrive. Their air support, their medical support, their support battalions. And that information can be used in planning the timing requirements of the actual mission, placement of blocking units and ambushing units, reinforcements and escape and evasion routes. Rehearsal, ladies and gentlemen. To scale mock-ups of an enemy base can be done in the sand with sticks and little twigs and bushes and lines. Another area to consider is exploitation of vulnerabilities. This one's important too. Because the vulnerabilities, ladies and gentlemen, of the enemy can be determined by observing the established pattern of his trained troops. The underground knows that highly trained troops respond in a given manner and attempts to capitalize on these patterns. But the underground also looks for overconfidence on the part of the enemy troops knowing that the most vulnerable part of the enemy's system may be that which appears to be invulnerable. Communication systems also produce vulnerabilities. Typically, in a large invading or attacking force on our soil and anywhere, there's a tendency to centralize most communication systems. Out of necessity, range, equipment, availability, etc. So that lateral communications, however, between different military organizations are not as rapid as vertical communications within a single organization. And what that means is, because of the consolidation of communications, again, based on just simple time and distance constraints, equipment restraints, training restraints of a force invading you, they will typically have the ability for the platoon to immediately get a hold of the company, and the company typically will be able to immediately get hold of the battalion and brigade and regiment and division and so on, up the chain, vertically. But horizontally, when that unit, if they're a supply unit getting attacked, going laterally to an infantry or MP unit for defense, when they've been ambushed, is often quite hard. They're not part of that infantry or MP unit. They're not part of the artillery support unit, air support. But don't fret if they have, based on your probing and intelligence, a very efficient and especially efficient, let's call it, communications and response system, because that can also be capitalized to your benefit, their efficiency. Because you can quickly divert enemy units by staging diversionary attacks and divert them through their quick response and usage of resources, false alarms, small raids on distant outposts, and exhaust them and their supplies. So remember that, ladies and gentlemen. There's several distinct opportunities and techniques that have been used by insurgents to exploit vulnerabilities throughout history: infiltration, surprise, deception, and diversion. And one that you can see every day on the news: creation of fatigue through continuous harassment and provocation. Take heed, ladies and gentlemen. I'm not here just to waste breath on you. I'm giving you real-world examples and scenarios. So let's take, for instance, infiltration. Prior to a scheduled raid, underground agents may infiltrate an area and locate sympathizers who provide information about the target and the security forces. Frequently, infiltrators will devise a screen of lookouts and a system of signals. We covered much of this in the tactics series, which will run at the end of this series. The underground prepares the battlefield initially by moving in supplies, arms for use by units which will infiltrate later. If the target, for instance, was a strategic holding, location, building, previously infiltrated members of the underground disrupt internal defenses at the time of the raid. They might cut holes in barricades, or barbed wire, move machine guns to prevent overlapping fields of fire, sabotage weapons arsenals. You get the gist, ladies and gentlemen. Surprise. Rarely is there a possibility to actually surprise a well-trained enemy through a single act. like catching them asleep. I mean, outright. Asleep in their tents or something. So the really key to success, ladies and gentlemen, surprise attacks, is to always retain the initiative. Be fluid. And this is done through three-phase surprise operation, as it has been called. But I don't want to really get into that right now, and I didn't do that on purpose. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm just thinking of the vastness of this next step, a surprise and initiative, and seizing the initiative and retaining the initiative. I don't want to get into it and have it cut with tomorrow's episode. So we're going to stop there for this evening. And I want to make sure that you all understand some of the current goings on here at the Hour of the Time and specials. The Sedona series. First time introduced ever. It's in digital, professionally produced and edited. It is an excellent quality presentation, ladies and gentlemen. And I would say one of the higher quality, if not the highest quality, of old past archives that we've done thus far. Many thanks to Rob and the Canadians and James in New York for getting that accomplished. And we're getting on a routine to hopefully be doing one a month now of the old archives. $25 postage paid donation. Hot Club members, simply enter in your Hot Club code in the shopping cart, or just do the math and write it down. If you enter in your Hot Club code because you're using the shopping cart, it'll automatically calculate it for you. If you forgot your code or lost it, just contact me at phone 928-333-2942. Better yet, email hourofthetime@hotmail.com and I'll give you your code. If you're sending in the mail, $15 is all it is for Hot Club members. They always get bonuses for helping us and their continual support. Don't forget CMRI.TV, Charlie Mike Romeo India.TV, 2 and 6 p.m. Pacific Time. 2 and 6 p.m. Pacific Time, Mondays and Fridays, this week's episodes, Herbal Walks and Training with David Christopher from the School of Natural Healing from last year's wonderful conference, to give you a taste of some of the stuff we do, if you're considering coming or already coming. Or if you have no intentions but want to see some cool video and learn something. And next week will be something many of you have wanted to see that just obviously can't just fly out to Arizona to see the gravesite. It's a 30-minute snippet of the construction of it, what's there, and the memorial to Bill. And also don't forget, obviously, this year's conference, Conference 2007. Go to our website, hourofthetime.com, and look at the Conference 2007 page. I guarantee you will not be disappointed if you come and attend. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank all of you for tuning in. I hope you're learning a lot. I'm sure you are based on feedback I'm getting, and we have a lot more in store for you. Take notes, and don't forget we're listener-supported, so please donate for these broadcasts in the form of CD, or you can wait because we're going to have a bundled package special in MP3 format. And don't forget to thank those who make it possible for the Hour of the Time to exist. That outside help. James at Christian Media, Monty at Radio Free Vermont, send them an email. Let them know you appreciate their efforts. Alrighty, I hope everyone has a safe and a studious evening and talk to you on the next episode of the Hour of the Time.